We as real people are autonomously animated by our brain. So our digital people are being autonomously animated by a digital brain.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. We all want to figure out how technology can make our lives easier. Some people jump in headfirst and some people are a little more trepidatious. One major disruption right now is conversational AI, which is why we wanted to speak to Greg Cross. He's co-founder and chief business officer of Soul Machines, which uses cutting-edge AI and conversational design technology to create digital people, which are used by companies and organizations around the world. These digital people can serve a number of purposes, including but not limited to serving the public with health information amidst the pandemic. So I wanted to talk to him about that. But first, Greg, welcome to Future Proof.
Hey, Jeremy. Nice to meet you. Nice to be talking to all your listeners today.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you. I wanted to first ask you what we start people out with, which is just who are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis? Because I think it's a very interesting world that a lot of people might not be privy to.
Yeah, I probably sound a little bit funny to some of your audience. So I'm a Kiwi, so I'm a New Zealander, although I spent a lot of my life living and working as a tech entrepreneur in the United States. So I have two grown-up kids there. As a tech entrepreneur, yeah, I guess we're always living a little bit in the future, and we're always thinking, and not just about the ways in which, you know, we can create new technology, but the ways in which new technology can make a difference in the lives that we lead, whether that's from a business perspective, from a community perspective, or from a society perspective. And, you know, one of the really cool things about Soul Machines, which is after a lifetime or a long career doing a whole bunch of different tech stuff, this is really one of the most interesting things. This is the most interesting thing I've done in my life. So, yeah, it's the most fun thing I've done in my life, because it really is. We're really thinking quite deeply about the way in which we are going to create the future and the way in which we're going to make a difference in the future. So, yeah, we spend a lot of time thinking about this future world that, you know, is right here, right now.
No, I think that's great. How would you describe Soul Machines' mission in a nutshell?
What we think about is a whole bunch of different things. We live in an era, you know, so this decade is obviously a decade of immense change. This time last year, we were still thinking about a lot of what we're thinking about is the fourth industrial revolution. The robots are coming. They're going to steal our jobs. They're going to rule over us. So, you know, our world was going to be changed by AI. And yes, all of that stuff is going to happen. You know, all of that stuff is actually happening as we speak. So we were always going to have this enormous period of change in our workplace, in our communities, in our societies over this, you know, 2020s decade. There was always going to be a period of enormous change. And in the last 12 months, we've overlaid, you know, the pandemic era that we now live in as well. And in many ways, that's accelerated what we do and the relevance of what we do, because so much more of how we remain connected, how we do our work, how we conduct business, how we buy products and services, we're now doing digitally. We're now doing online. What we're about is AI and machines, you know, are becoming a bigger and bigger part of our everyday life. And what we think about and what drives us is we believe that those machines and those AI systems become more understandable, more relatable, and more trustable if they're more like us, if they are more human-like in the way in which we can interact with them. You know, one way to think about us is, I mean, literally we're putting a face on a machine. We're introducing human behavior to artificial intelligence so that when we're interacting with a machine, when we're talking with a machine, we're enjoying the things that we're wired to enjoy as human beings. We enjoy face-to-face conversations. Our conversations and our communications are enormously more effective and efficient when we're doing that with the context of face-to-face interaction, where you can not just hear my voice and the tone of my voice, but you can see me. You can see the emotion I have on the face, the gestures I'm using in order to talk about what I'm doing. So these are the sorts of things that we think about. We talk about the democratization of personal experience. You know, so if I break that down, you know, personal experience is something that we don't all get the opportunity for these days. So if I pick two really fundamental services, human services, healthcare and education. You know, personal experience is teaching in health, and in education is teaching. In healthcare, it's access to medical professionals, nurses and doctors, people who can help us when we're sick. And we simply, in the world today, even in wealthy economies like America, like New Zealand, like the United Kingdom, we don't have enough teachers and we don't have enough doctors. We just don't. You know, so when I talk about democratizing personal experience in the healthcare space or in the education space, you know, how can we use digital people not to replace humans but to do some of the things that, you know, and enable us to amplify the capability of the professionals we have working in these fields? That's what I mean when I talk about democratizing personal experience. You know, we would love to see a world where kids anywhere and everywhere can access education, can access knowledge, can learn.
Which, by the way, which I feel like we all, I'd be very surprised about the people who don't agree with those sentiments. I always feel that I have to play devil's advocate because I know some of the audience. And I know one thing that people will push back on is, like I've read, like you said, that you have a fundamental belief that machines can be more helpful to us if they're more like us. But why do you feel that way? Because I think there are a lot of people who have seen these science fiction movies from my childhood where that leads to negative consequences. Are there negative consequences that we should be concerned of? Or is it just a matter of the potential gains far outweigh the potential negatives?
Sure. I mean, and that's a, I mean, wow, you've just opened, you know, a whole big subject there. So let me break it down. So yeah, Hollywood, in terms of robots, in terms of the AI machine future, I mean, Hollywood's always done a great job in the science fiction genre of stimulating our imagination. And our imagination is a good thing. You know, they have created this narrative that the robots are coming and they're going to kill us and rule over us, and we're all going to have to move. We're all like Elon Musk. We're going to have to move to Mars to save ourselves from the robots. So, yeah, that's one. I mean, that's a dystopian perspective of the future. We have a different view of that, and there are things that we are learning as we move along, go along the way. And as a company, we're 4.5 years old. We've built around about 50 digital people working for companies and organizations in different industries and in different countries, different communities around the world. So we've learned a whole bunch of things. So here's some of the things that we have learned. History would teach us whenever we have an industrial revolution, you know, we as humans adapt. In the last industrial revolution, so when we electrified our factories, you know, I often ask this question, who was the most displaced group of workers in the last industrial revolution? You know, the most displaced group of workers was child slave labor in our factories. Now, was that a good thing or a bad thing? You know, I think most people would say that was a good thing. You know, what other people forget, so when we go back and study that as use history to predict the future, when those children stopped having to work in factories, our governments of the day stepped in and mandated that big organizations had to set up schools to educate and teach those kids new skills and capabilities so they could make a contribution. So out of that massive change, you know, we saw the modern public education system emerge. The first thing I'd say to your listeners is, as humans, we are adaptable. When, you know, look, when I left high school, the industry in which I built my whole career, the tech industry, just didn't exist. You know, my parents used to say, what are you going to be when you grow up? One, I don't really want to grow up, and I'll still tell them that today. And two, you know, I've ended up building a successful career in an industry that just didn't exist when I left high school. That's part of fundamentally what we believe. So as we develop new technologies, we solve problems, we by and large put our technology to use in a good way, in a way that benefits us. So I believe in that. We're learning really important stuff on a day-to-day basis. We actually have hard evidence that in many industries, people prefer to speak to digital people than real people. And you might say, why? And the question is, the reason why is, you know, when we talk to a real person, often we fear judgment. So we've learned from the work we've done with banks and mortgage applications and loan applications. We fear rejection. We've learned in healthcare areas like, you know, STIs and mental health areas. You know, these are areas where, once again, people often don't want to talk to real people because of judgment. Learning's another area. You know, we all, when we went to high school, learned, you know, another language, but very few of us learn how to speak that language fluently. I know I don't speak French or German or Latin even, and which were my high school subjects. I learned enough to pass. At some point, you stop putting up your hand to ask questions because you get judged by your peers, you get judged by your teachers. So there are so many use cases where, you know, this type of technology can actually be enormously helpful.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense the way you put it like that. And I think maybe it'd be helpful if we crystallize for people the concept of a digital human, which is, to me, pretty intuitive. But how do you define that?
So a digital person in the context of what we do, so we're leveraging a number of different technologies that exist in the world today. So we are starting with creating our digital people, which is CGI. And CGI is something we've used in the movie industry and the games industry to create characters and that we can that tell us stories and play with us. And we've done that for a very long time. So our digital people, another generation of computer-generated images, CGI characters. We build hyper-realistic characters, which we create digital twins. So we, you know, last year built a digital twin of Will I Am from the Black Eyed Peas. Will's digital twin is an exact twin of him. It replicates not just his likeness, but his personalities, his voice, his mannerisms, and his behavior. So behind the CGI is an animation system. So when you think of Hollywood and movies like Avatar and King Kong, those CGI characters who tell the stories are created by artists, by CGI artists, and then they're animated by actors. The actors are recorded performing the scene, telling the story. The data is captured using, you know, highly specialized, expensive camera equipment. And then, so the data is captured using motion capture cameras, motion capture suits. We've probably all seen some video of that. Data is collected, and then the animation is then attached to the CGI character and brought to life. So that's how animation works in the movie industry and in the games industry. In our world, the artificial intelligence world, we're doing something we call autonomous animation. So our, you know, research, our area of specialist intellectual property is in this field of autonomous animation. So the simplest way to explain autonomous animation is that it's live, it's interactive, it's in real time. So we're having, and Jeremy, we're having an interactive conversation here today. You're being animated by your brain in terms of the questions you're asking, how you're responding to what, how I'm responding, and I'm being animated by my brain. So we, as real people, are autonomously animated by our brain. So our digital people are being autonomously animated by a digital brain, a brain that our neuroscientists, our developmental psychologists, our software engineers have been building since 2012, when we were just a research lab at a university. They've been building this working model of aspects of the human brain that enables our CGI, our digital people, to come to life in real time. So that's, you know, when we talk about digital people in our world, they're the core technologies and core components. Of course, we use other technologies. We use natural language processing engines, or the conversational AI engines that Google, Microsoft, IBM, Amazon, and a bunch of other people produce. We can use facial recognition software, object recognition software, all different parts of, you know, what I'd call the AI stack, or different systems that get broadly classified as AI, you know, as sitting in that AI bucket, as I refer to it. AI tends to be used as a very generic term. In fact, there's a whole range of really specific technologies. For us, you know, what we do, we build the digital people and we autonomously animate them, and that they are our specialties in the world of artificial intelligence.
And I thought that the example that you partnered with a few pretty major groups to put together Florence to combat, in some ways, COVID-19, but really focused on tobacco, I thought that was a really interesting implementation and an example of how these types of things can be leveraged for good and not just for profits, if you want to talk about that a bit.
Yeah. Look, you can't be in the world of AI without being, as I guess we've already touched on, being enormously focused on doing the right thing, enormously focused on, the ethical use of technology. So when COVID-19 came along this time last year, we asked ourselves a question: how could we make a difference? Call centers were overloaded. Nobody had information. Information was changing on a 24/7 basis. So the current ways of communicating got overloaded completely. So we started looking at the ways we could create a digital COVID-19 advisor, always up to date, the not getting sick, infinitely scalable because it's cloud-based technology. So we could, if we needed 100,000 digital people to speak to, we could create 100, we could serve $100,000 digital people. So we came up with this idea. We went and pitched it to the World Health Organization. And they got really excited about us being able to help them with two things: helping them dispel, myths and fake news around COVID-19, and helping them with the smoking cessation message. Prior to COVID-19, one of the biggest programs that the World Health Organization, maintains around the world is quit smoking. It's a big health problem. And if you're a smoker and you combine that with COVID-19, mortality rates and your chances of surviving change quite dramatically. We worked with our colleagues at Amazon. So our technology served from, AWS in the cloud. We worked with our colleagues at Google, who are providing the conversational AI engine the knowledge base that Florence is being stored to. And we all, we all went to the World Health Organization, and we were prepared to donate our time and our services because, we felt, our partners felt, that this was something we wanted, an opportunity. We wanted to showcase the difference we could make, and we wanted to see if we could, make a difference in this time. So the fantastic thing is we launched Florence in less than 2 months. So she got announced. We had our first conversations with the World Health Organization in May. We launched Florence in July. Florence was launched speaking English. We're just now rolling out digital Florence speaking the 6 languages of the United Nations. I think just last week it was Spanish was the first non-English speaking language to go. Been a fascinating learning curve, and really awesome to see that it can make a difference in the way in which that we can look at the economics of delivering healthcare going forward into the future. We think this has been a really important period of time to show what AI, what digital people can contribute during a pandemic, during a crisis.
Yeah, there's a lot there, but I think that, that definitely answers a lot of questions I had about it. And I find it so fascinating, obviously, as you said, because that can certainly scale up. That's one advantage to having digital people. But as humans, what is our resistance to the concept of digital people in terms of what you've encountered?
Resistance comes from perception versus reality. So a lot of people's perception of AI and machines and robots and digital people is being created by Hollywood. We've touched on that. So there's an initial level of resistance. But what we found in terms of the user experience testing that we've done with our big clients is people adapt and engage really quickly with digital people. Customer satisfaction rates, and we found, and NPS scores we found with our clients go way up because they're feeling like they're getting rapid attention, more personal attention. And if they need to speak to a real person, real people are available to help out because a lot of the problems that people take to websites with, or chatbots or help desks with, these are questions that can be answered relatively simply and relatively straightforward. There's 10% of the questions that come through which are really gnarly and really difficult, and in reality are going to always require real human creativity to solve that particular problem. So it's a matter of how can we dramatically improve that overall customer experience. And we've seen some really dramatic, improvements in terms of customer service, in terms of customer satisfaction rates. And the number of people who would, be quite happy to speak to a digital person again, typically sits well above 80%. The impact we have when we put a digital brand ambassador inside of an e-commerce store, You know, so when you're shopping on an e-commerce store, and we double the amount of money we spend in online shopping in the last 12 months, we don't get a personal experience like we do when we go into a real shop. But we've now started to put digital brand ambassadors inside of e-commerce stores, and our clients once again have seen sales, have seen upsells, have seen conversion rates improve because they can create a more personal shopping experience. So these are some of the things. I also touched on this whole area of people feel quite more comfortable not being judged by a digital person, you know, and they're not scared to ask a dumb question or to ask the same question over and over again.
Yeah, I think that's a really major advantage. I know that whenever I'm talking, let's say, to a chatbot, because of something that I had forgotten, I feel, or like you said, if it's a dumb or silly question, there are no silly questions because you don't have that judgment. But I'm wondering also, I'm sure you have this, is there data to support that a digital face is more engaging than a chatbot or a voice assistant? There's something about that human connection that's evoked by seeing somebody, even if it's a digital somebody?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're seeing data. Most of our customers that we're working with today, they have chatbots, they have voice assistants. But, you know, adding a face personalizes the experience in a completely, you know, different way. So there is data from academic research all the way through to user experience research and testing. And look, there are times when, you know, it makes more sense to use a chatbot still. We are seeing substantial improvements in closure rates. Closure rates, you know, when people talk to a digital people, are almost double those of when people are talking to a chatbot, i.e. people getting what they want in a timely and efficient manner. As human beings, you know, I talked at the outset, we're wired for face-to-face interaction. We build relationships and trust through face-to-face interactions. These are important dynamics, you know, and there's both academic research and real-life research that we've done that shows that there are benefits. But there are times, you know, when we'll choose to use a chat, a text box to ask a question. We might be on in a public place, and we might not want to have a conversation about what our bank balance is. And so maybe we're going to integrate the chatbot experience or the voice assistant experience into the digital person experience. There may be times when a simple text conversation may be more appropriate.
Yeah. And again, it's not to harp on the negatives or, you know, potential negatives. I think it's just natural. As futurists, we have to think about the unintended consequences of anything, you know, action that we take. On one hand, digital humans can revolutionize the economics of customer service, for instance, as just one example. On the other hand, what potential unintended consequences could arise as a result, which I'm sure you're thinking of, and then how do you protect against those things occurring?
There are lots of things that we think of and we have to continue to think of. We think very carefully about things like diversity of digital people populations, because I think people should be able to choose whether they are speaking to a male or a female, whether they're speaking to somebody of the same ethnicity of them, the same language in the same language that they have, as someone of the same age that they have. These are all diversity issues we need to think about. There are many lessons we can take from some of the problems we're starting to see in social media. As a company, we've made some pretty important ethical position. We've taken some pretty strong ethical positions. We won't allow our digital people to be used in the sex industry, to sell tobacco, we won't allow digital politicians. These are use cases where we're just saying this doesn't, based on what we've seen, what we're learning from technologies today, these are things that we want to guard against. There are areas around data privacy with when you're dealing with digital people and AI. The implications, you know, of data privacy become exponentially more and infinitely more complex, and you have to be very thoughtful and careful about some of these things. So these are the sorts of areas that we're thinking about, and as I say, as we come across them, we're looking to learn lessons that hard lessons that have been learned, things that we've already seen blow up today, the whole fake news phenomena in social media as an example.
No, I think these are really good. Some of them I had thought of, some of them, honestly, I hadn't. I'm a big believer that if you can at least imagine some of these things that you don't want to happen, then you can put those guardrails in place in order to make sure that doesn't occur. And I know you have to head out in a minute or two, but this has been great. I'd love to ask you one last question. As a futurist, how do you correct for your own biases when trying to make better predictions on an ongoing basis? And I'm asking, I guess, in the context of you have almost a thesis behind all of the work that you do. I'm sure that a lot of it is proven correct. And then every now and then you're given some new information that you've got to assimilate that might go against what you had previously thought. A lot of people struggle with that. So how do you deal with that when that occurs?
Yeah. You know, for me, from a personal point of view, one, I love learning with the proposition that every day is a learning experience, an opportunity to learn something. When you're working with new technologies like this, you have to be prepared to be honest and look yourself in the mirror and be able to say, look, some things we just don't know what we don't know. One of the things that I always think about in this is, yes, we have a vision. Yes, we have a picture of what the world could look like. And we make a series of assumptions, which we use to drive key decisions about the technology we develop, the types of businesses we're trying to create, the business models we're trying to implement. So we all of these things, you know, this is with technology like this, and it's an enormously creative endeavor. The principle that I have and the principle I enunciate to my team is it's our job to make a set of assumptions and make a series of decisions so that we can continue to move forward. We have to continue to move forward into the future. But the absolutely critical piece of this puzzle is being clear that it really doesn't matter whether your assumptions are right or wrong. It's how quickly you prove they are right or wrong. It's how quickly you use what you learn to make a different decision that really matters in the end. Yeah, that's personally how I think about it as somebody who's creating a small part of the future world that we're going to live in.
I really like that. I think that a lot of people can learn from that way of thinking. So that's a great note to end on. But Greg, thank you so much for making the time and joining us.
My pleasure, Jeremy. It's been a blast. I've really enjoyed talking to it. To you, I hope we've touched on some things that are interesting, provocative, and for your audience as well.
Thanks again to Greg for making the time. I really enjoyed that. And I know a lot of people enjoyed the pushback, as we've seen in the comments, playing devil's advocate whenever possible. But his area is definitely one to watch over the next few years. If you like what you just heard, and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Future Proof, as that's the number one way we get the show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and V. Corduccio, and assistant producer Aaron Cohen. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.